Tonight's event is called Morality to Change the World, and we have a very exciting event. I had dinner with the panelists. I think it's going to be a great conversation. We would like to thank Columbia College Chicago's Humanities, History, and Social Sciences Department. We also want to thank Insight Press and the Eighth Day Center for Justice. Our first speaker is Bob Bossy. He has been a staff person at the Eighth Day Center for Justice in Chicago since 1980. He works on issues of peace, human rights, economics, and nonviolence. In 1991, he was a member of the International Gulf Peace Team, which situated itself between the opposing forces in nonviolent opposition to the Gulf War. In 1996, Bob helped found Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign to end the economic sanctions against the people of Iraq. Bob has been involved in many of these sorts of acts and has been arrested numerous times and spent some time in jail. Bob is a member of the Priests of the Sacred Heart, an international congregation. He travels frequently to Latin America, the Middle East, Europe, and Canada. Before joining his religious congregation, Bob was a member of the U.S. Air Force and the military industry, where he worked on nuclear weapons and other weapon systems. Let's welcome Bob Bossy.
So let me tell you something about myself that you haven't already heard. I'm one of 10 children, 7 of whom lived to adulthood. I grew up in Boston and joined the U.S. Air Force, as you heard a little while ago, at the ripe old age of 17, for a 4-year term. Following that, I worked for the military industry, as you heard, for another 5 years. During those 9 years of my then 27 years, I worked on a variety of weapon systems, including nuclear weapons-carrying aircraft. Nowadays, I want to say that during those 9 years with the military, no one ever asked me if what I was doing was moral or not. No one in my church, schools, family, or social network. It was assumed that what I was doing was patriotic, a service to the community. And you notice the word service. We continue to use that today. Were you in the service? Even my activist friends say, were you in the service? If you loved me during that time, for a variety of reasons, if you were close to me, I hope that you would have had the love, the deep enough sense of love of me, to ask me if what I was doing was moral or not. Toward the end of that time period, I recall telling a young woman who seemed attracted to me that I was searching for something and I didn't know what it was, but I'd know it if and when I found. About a year later, when I had given up on the search and even told the God that I knew at the time that I'm sorry but you're not good enough, I had an experience of God at which I was in and of God. You might go so far as to say, as I was God. At that moment, I realized that I was holy and lovable, and each and everyone else, and every other creature of faith, was also wholly good, lovable, and worthy of reverence. Several years later, I had an experience in Latin America and continued to pursue that experience in which I realized that I must identify with the oppressed and the poor, or my experience of God would be disingenuous. All of this, along with numerous other experiences through the years, has led me to several conclusions. First of all, as I said, well, not first of all, but the first thing is that everyone must trust the goodness in their own heart of hearts. That will lead them on the path of mercy, justice, and love. The second thing I came to the conclusion is I need to hang around with those other people who are pursuing a God-centered relationship, and the those who don't, if I want to have any integrity about myself. Third thing I realized that Jesus is God. When I had this experience of God, a friend of mine invited me to go to a Fresia, which is a Hispanic motivated retreat. And I told him, I said, Charlie, I said, I had an experience of God, but I don't know if he's Christian. And for some reason, I started going to church every day, because this is all crazy, but I wanted to be a priest. But even though I didn't know if I was Christian or not, but when I found myself sitting in the pews at church, I found myself sitting with my jaw slacked when they were reading the scripture, and I realized that Jesus is God, is my God. And that's when I identified myself as a Christian. But since then, I've also identified myself with the God of Moses and the God of Muhammad. The Bible echoes in many places that experience of God, the God of my life. Here I'm reminded of Matthew 25, where I'm sure many of you know it says, what you do to the least of them, you do to me. And Isaiah 57, where it says, this is the fast I wish, releasing those bound unjustly, setting free the oppressed, breaking every yoke, sharing your bread with the hungry, sheltering the oppressed and the homeless, clothing the naked when you see them. Don't get me wrong. Through the centuries, and especially today, the Bible has been used as a tool of oppression. The domination of women by men and the stifling of scientific thought come to mind here. For these reasons, I think it's appropriate to critique the Bible. I engage in a regular critique of the Bible and denounce to God who is portrayed as vengeful and duplicitous. I also use biblical studies that challenge me to see its message in today's context. One of my friends said to me once that I talk too much about social justice when I'm preaching. And I realized that my struggle is to try and understand where God is present in the world. So these particular readings that are back on the back table were helpful to me. One was entitled Binding the Strong Man, a political reading of Mark's Gospel, and the other one was Becoming Children of God, John's Gospel and Radical Discipleship. They continue to be an important reflection for me. In this same sense of critiquing the Bible, it's essential to acknowledge, and I don't think a lot of people know this. I didn't know until I was stuck in the seminary for a while. It's essential to acknowledge that the Bible is a library of books. It's not just one book. And it's of various kinds of books, of poetry, of story, of metaphor, and in Daniel and Revelations, what some people call the Apocalypse, it's a book of resistance literature. It was written in a time of great oppression, and a time of people's struggle to establish their own dignity. The Bible is a record of the experience of who God is for these many people from diverse backgrounds. This experience is filtered through the vagaries of their human condition with all that that implies, as is our experience today. But God, then another conclusion I came to, God is more than all of this. God is more than what is in the Bible, our understanding, our religion, our ideology. Yet all of these are permeated by God for me. Science and religion inform one another. This is what I've come to this conclusion. I come from a technical background. I like science, although I haven't got much of a degree or background in scientific study. But the way they inform one another is my experience. And in my understanding of the Big Bang theory, chaos theory, field theory, and quantum mechanics, they influence the way I see God in the world and God working in the world. I understand evolution as the ongoing creative action of God, of which we are part through our choices. Our choices have consequences. As chaos theory reminds us about the influence of the... Have you heard that story about the butterfly in Hawaii? It wags its wings. And that's sort of the culminating factor in changing the climate conditions that produce a hurricane in the United States. That's sort of the notion of chaos theory, that actions, all actions, no matter how small, have their consequence and influence one another. So for me, God is in every one and in everything. We are called to reverence all and to call them to be more than they are, including ourselves. That which we oppose in the other is also in us, whether we like it. Society is not just a one-on-one relation. It's not just one-on-one relations. It's also a pattern of predetermined relationships, what we call systems. Economic, Jay reminds me that it actually is capitalism. the political system, the religious system, the cultural system. How much time do I got? I'm going to do it. 10 minutes, thank you. I wanted to divert for a minute. Today I read the Indian people are displaced on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border because of U.S. drones. The attacks that they're just wiping out villages in there. The U.S. is imposing upon the Pakistani army to bomb these areas, supposedly to get rid of Al-Qaeda in there. And so there's a million people that have been displaced. And I was saying on the way over here that it doesn't matter where you really come down. Well, maybe it does. It does to me, but it doesn't matter in a lot of ways where you come down in this discussion tonight. The political system that we're living in is just really revolting. I mean, I'm trying to be totally... I'm trying to be totally respectful. I know some people are just on the Obama and Michelle bandwagon, you know. And I mean, I'm very attracted to them. I find them very attractive people. But that has nothing to do with it. It's got to do with their policies and stuff. So it's got to do with the system in which we are enmeshed, you and I. And whatever our motivation, we have to be about changing that. And I know I'm depressing it, but hurting myself. I can't help it. These systems are insidious. And they manifest themselves through agreed-upon signs and symbols that evoke all sorts of emotions and background. You know, I was raised a Catholic. You know, the cross means a million different things to me. The flag, I was raised a traditional Catholic in Boston. I mean, the flag means a lot of different things to me. Now I see it as a gang symbol. I mean, I'm not saying that to be a spy out. I was in a courtroom once and I had some friends around the trial, and I looked at the flag and I said, my God, it's gang colors. I'm not saying that to be a spy out. Like, it's the way that these symbols insinuate themselves into us as individuals and as community. I think of the Nike swoosh symbol. You know, that means sweatshops for a lot. I mean, it means $200 shoes that they used to have for families to buy for their kids. It used to be murder on the streets of Chicago to get a pair of Nike shoes because of this stupid symbol. You know? And it's got to do with rituals. Symbols have to do with rituals. Producing goods and shopping is a pretty good symbol, a ritual. And the roles that we play, and I think of the president, again, Obama, and CEOs of corporations, and priests, and teachers. These current systems are based upon, most often, power over, when they should be based upon power with, or shared power. One way of unpacking this power relationship is to ask, and I ask people to remember these questions, when you're talking about a relationship or a system, is who decides in the system, and who benefits, and who suffers the consequences of those decisions. And when I say who suffers, I think of the earth itself. And what values are being manifested by that? These systems were created by humans and must be changed by them. And for me, this is love in action. It's my fervent belief that we must be engaged in a revolutionary struggle, a nonviolent revolutionary struggle, where all systems are called into question, including those with which we ourselves most identify, be that our culture, or our nationality, or our economic or class status, our religion, or our ideology. Everything has to be called into question, has to be open to question. So in conclusion, in some ways for me, all of what I have said so far can be summed up in three ways. The first is what I've said already, my deepest belief, that everyone and everything is in and of God. They are all holy, good, lovable, and worthy of reverence. Especially those who are poor and the poor earth of which we are part. And my last two comments are quotes. The first one is I read it a place in D.C. years ago, the Center for Creative Nonviolence. And then on the wall they had this, they said, when they come for the innocent, and do not cross your body, cursed be your religion and your life. And then the last one is a song from Latin America that always touches me. It's in La Lucha, I bogus recompenses. In the struggle, rewards are few. In fact, I know only two. Loving friends and living dreams. Such rewards are not so few in some. Thank you, and I welcome your questions or comments later. And my final encouragement is tonight I hope we can help each other find a way.
Next speaker is Sansara Taylor. Sansara Taylor is a writer for Revolution newspaper and uncompromising atheist. Her coverage of the rise of Christian fascism has taken her to the gates of abortion clinics across the country, to Terri Schiavo's hospice, to inside the stadiums of the Battle Cry movement, to train Christian youth shock troops, and led to numerous impressive verbal battles with Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and countless thoughtful interviews with reality-based radio hosts. Sansara was one of the founders of the World Can't Wait movement to drive out the Bush regime, which The Nation magazine awarded the most effective protest group of 2007 for their efforts against the U.S. policy of torture. Ms. Taylor co-hosts WBAI radio program Equal Time for Free Thought. Ms. Taylor's national campus speaking tour on the book Away With All Gods, Unchaining the Mind and Radically Changing the World, the Baba Vakian, has brought her to urban high schools, campus groups, and academic departments, including the Center for the Study of Religion, UCLA. Let's welcome Ms. Taylor.
Priest sat down to discuss morality without gods. It's a great title, and I'm just thrilled to be a part of this. It's an opportunity. And indeed, despite the imperialist system's new president, the world does need change. It needs radical change, and it needs change urgently. So it's important that we're having this discussion on morality to change the world. Anyone who thought that Obama would bring the change that they should believe in should take a look at Afghanistan in addition to what we've just heard. I was going to mention that he's sending 21,000 more troops, and he's developed this new policy that is working with the so-called moderate sections of the Taliban and fundamentalists in Afghanistan. And all of this is tied together with U.S.-backed President Karzai in Afghanistan recently signing into law a new measure that will legalize the right of a husband to rape his wife, that will make it illegal for a woman to leave her home without his permission, that will make it, even if they don't go to the doctor or call the police, and that will deny her any custody rights over her children in case of divorce or widowhood. This is not the change that humanity needs. We do not need a new face on an imperialist system. Nor do we simply need a better way to live and to treat each other within the world that is dominated by imperialism. We need an end to imperialism. We need a revolution. A real revolution. The most radical revolution this planet has ever seen. We need communist revolution. And as part of that, we need communist morality to change the world. And this is, indeed, morality without gods. As he said, I've been traveling the country in the last few months. I've had the opportunity to speak on behalf of and promote this fantastic book, Away With All Gods, Unchaining the Mind and Radically Changing the World. It is written by Bob Avakian, who is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And while there are a lot of books out on atheism these days, there is no book that goes so thoroughly after all forms of religion and superstitious belief and exposes the harm that they do, while at the same time having tremendous confidence in people who are caught up in religious thinking, that they can break out of it. And there's no other book that so thoroughly grasps the horrors of this world that makes people feel the need to seek solace in religion, while at the same time understanding that these horrors can be changed in the real world, this world, the only world there is. And that for people, and especially oppressed people themselves, to be a part of that emancipation, they do have to come to deal with reality as it is, without belief in gods, because they don't exist. So, to get directly to the question of morality to change the world, and why this must be without gods, I'm going to sort of hinge what I have to say today around a quote from Marx. And it's a statement that both sheds light on where morality fundamentally comes from, and to where we need to look first and foremost when we talk about changing the world. And so Marx said, right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and its cultural development conditioned thereby. Don't worry, I will break this down a little bit. The statement actually concentrates a lot about the world, how it comes to be, and I think it'll be helpful to get into some examples to actually examine what this quote means and how it's significant. And I thought I would start with the Christian Bible itself. Because I know how it is with most people in this country. I myself was raised Christian. And even when you read the Bible, you go to church, you hear things, and a lot of times you hear things that strike you as profoundly wrong. You know, Moses commands his people, go out and slaughter the Midianites. They come back, they said, okay, we killed all the men, we took all the cattle, and Moses gets really mad. And he says, why is Moses mad? Not because he slaughtered the Midianites, but because Moses gets mad. Go back and you kill all the Midianites, all the boys, even if they're children. You kill all the women if they've known a man by sleeping with him. But the virgins, you take them for yourself. So this stuff is in the Bible. You read it, and you go to church, and you kind of just push it aside. You're trained that there must be some meaning, and there must be some good in it, and there must be, you know, God works in mysterious ways. The whole assumption is some things are beyond human understanding. So I know how it is. You kind of push it aside. But if you actually go and read the Bible and confront what's actually in it, this is a truly bloodthirsty book. It is filled with moral codes and commandments that are openly genocidal. In addition to stoning women who are not virgins when they get married, killing children if they're disobedient, killing homosexuals in Leviticus. I mean, this stuff is throughout the Bible, taking slaves. And this is not just one book of the Bible or two books of the Bible. It is the bulk of the Bible, the core message of the Bible, the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. And yes, it's consistent with the person and the message of Jesus Christ himself. So why is this? Going back to this quote from Marx about right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and the culture conditioned thereby, the people who wrote the Bible lived in slave-owning, agrarian, patriarchal societies. That was their economic structure. And that's how they lived. And so when, you know, they took slaves, they burned down each other's villages, and when they made up gods and mythology, they made up gods that reflected the world in which they lived, the ignorance of the times in which they lived, and reinforced the moral codes of those times. And it's revealing, because even today you have people who claim to be biblical literalists. You have openly Christian fascists, people like Judge Roy Moore and others, I'll talk about him, who today proclaim the Christian Bible, but they themselves won't come out and uphold all of what's actually in it. Judge Roy Moore is the one, you know, he's the guy down in Alabama who actually broke into his own courthouse in the middle of the night to install those gigantic stone tablets of the Ten Commandments. And the revealing thing is that when he put in his own commandments, he censored them. And it's kind of funny if you say that it's the inerrant word of God and you're not supposed to pick and choose. He picked and chose, which is what a lot of these fundamentalists do. And so for the Tenth Commandment, he just put, thou shalt not covet. And he didn't go on to list what's said in the Bible, what you're not supposed to covet. If you read the Bible, it says you're not supposed to covet your neighbor's oxen, asses, wife, and slaves. It doesn't condemn slavery, it just says don't be jealous of your neighbor's slaves. And why does Judge Moore and other Christian fascists today leave this out? It's not because they're profoundly enlightened people. Surely with the outright assault on the scientific fact of evolution, on women's fundamental right to abortion and even birth control, on the way they champion the U.S.'s wars for empire as God's wars, these are not enlightened people. They leave out the part about slavery because we no longer live in a society whose economic foundation is based in slavery. And so today the sense of right has also changed. Today, instead of living in a society rooted in slavery, we live in a society whose economic foundation is capitalism. This is the material requirements of life, food, clothing, shelter, and the ability to raise the next generation, are produced through the purchase of labor power. You know, people get paid a wage to work. This is how everything gets produced. And when people get paid a wage, they get paid about enough on average to keep themselves alive and to be able to continue working and to raise another generation of people to work at basically the same level. Whereas those who pay the wage, the capitalists, they pay enough to keep the workers going, but they actually are able to take private ownership at the end of the day or the end of the process of production. And what's produced is worth more value than the people who labor get paid. So out of this, they get profit. And the more this goes on, they get a profit, then they can reinvest and do that on a grander scale. And the more this process goes, the more there's a concentration of wealth at one end and disparity and poverty at the other end. And this is the fundamental law of capitalism. This is socialized production, private appropriation. And this is how everything we need in this world to survive gets produced. If we were all to look at the labels on our clothes right now and see every part of the world and take off everything that was made through sweatshop labor, we would be a very naked bunch, and we would be having an entirely different kind of gathering right now. But this is the foundation of society. But this conditions in this society, this economic foundation conditions the culture and the sense of morality and right. And to take this just a little further, like in today's society, it's perfectly legal, and somebody would have the right, if they're a CEO or a factory owner, to go and lay off hundreds of people or thousands of people if they can no longer make a profit exploiting them. And they'd have the right to even move their factory to some other part of the world where people are more desperate to make more money exploiting them. That's legal and that's considered a right. Whereas people who've been deprived the ability to work, say the people who got fired, if they were to go into a store and take the food they need, they don't have the right to do that. Structures, economic structures of capitalism, you have the right to exploit, but you can never have the right to eat. And this is starkly on display last year. I don't know if people followed this, but there's been this huge food crisis in the world. And in 28 countries last year, there were gigantic food riots, people literally starving. And the ironic part, or maybe the most outrageous part of this, was that a lot of these countries where people were starving and having food riots were food-producing countries. They were agricultural countries, but they are dominated by the global networks of imperialism, and what they produced, the food and the agricultural goods, were for export. They were for the right of the imperialists to make a profit off of them, not for the rights of the people to eat, including the people who produced the food. It is this economic foundation of capitalism and imperialism, not human nature, not simply human greed, not even scarcity, that causes the problems that humanity confronts today. And if we want to change the world, we have to do more than do unto others as we would have them do unto us. We need to do more than love our neighbors as ourselves. We need to do more than acts of charity. We need to dig down to the economic foundations of society and change all of this through revolution. It's like that old saying goes, if I feed the poor, they call me a saint, but if I ask why the poor are hungry, they call me a communist. We need a communist revolution. We need to liberate the productive forces of society. Most importantly, people themselves, but also technology, the natural resources and tools, and everything else that goes into producing things. We need to break the grip of the capitalist class from being able to enforce, with their military might, their police and their courts, their right to exploit. And we have to establish a new state power, a revolutionary state power, whose economy is based on meeting the people's needs on an ever-expanding basis and unleashing their conscious participation, including their critical thinking, their artistic expression, their impatience, and their individuality. In this context, a whole new sense of right and culture can and must flourish. If you have an economic structure that is based on digging up the divisions of society into exploiter and exploited, into haves and have-nots, then you no longer need to maintain and enforce patriarchal lines of inheritance from one generation to the next. You no longer have the structural need for patriarchy and the oppression and subjugation of women. For the first time, you can have a morality and a culture that corresponds to the full emancipation of women, to seeing women first as human beings capable of participating fully and equally with men in every realm of human endeavor, rather than being valued primarily in terms of childbearing or their attractiveness or usefulness to men. If you have an economic foundation based on meeting people's needs rather than private property and profit, you can respond to a natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina radically different than this government did, where they took troops off of rescue missions, you guys remember this, and sent them back in with orders to shoot to kill looters. If you have an economic foundation of socialism, you would put rescuing people above protecting private property. You can have a different sense of morality and a different sense of right. If you have the economic foundation based on human beings being the most precious resource, rather than viewing them as expendable labor or cannon fodder, then you can have the right to education and science in a real way, not just in this country, but worldwide, because society would thrive through the conscious participation and activism of humanity as a whole. Communism, real scientific revolutionary communism, as it was developed by Marx and as it has been further developed by visionary leaders, including currently by Bavakian, is not a utopic vision destined to become a so-called totalitarian nightmare. This is a vision rooted in the actual resolution of the most defining material contradiction of this epoch in human history. That contradiction at the economic foundation of society between socialized production and private appropriation. Because this revolution is about emancipating all of humanity, this is a revolution that not only has no interest in obscuring the truth, it is also one that can only be made through the conscious participation of the masses of people themselves. This requires not a trust us attitude, but a scientific leadership that unleashes the conscious participation of the masses of people. And this is why part of the fight against the mental mental shackles of religion is so central and essential to the fight to change the world and make revolution. This is the complete opposite of telling people who are oppressed or suffering that there must be some meaning in it because God works in mysterious ways. And when we're talking about a revolutionary society, and when Bavakian writes, "Away with all gods," he is not talking about suppressing religion. He is talking precisely about what the subtitle of this book states, about unchaining the mind and radically changing the world. In a revolutionary society, people will be allowed to worship and believe as they like. But everyone will be learning the science of evolution. They'll be learning the real origins of life and of the way things change, and not just what is true, but how you come to understand what's true, the scientific method, so that people themselves can understand the world and be a to stop the war in Iraq and protested to no avail. Instead, they will be increasingly unleashed to be a conscious part of changing the whole world and themselves in the process. The alienation and atomization of this society that makes people feel so lonely and in need of something greater that is non-material to believe in will be being broken down as people are no longer forced to compete with each other merely for survival. In this context, mass debate and ferment will be unleashed as people are encouraged to hold everything, their own beliefs, the thinking of others, and yes, the revolutionary leadership and party that's leading society as well, all of this up to critical interrogation and examination. And in this context, people, when they are ready, will increasingly cast off the outmoded myths of religion and in the belief in God himself. Bob Bacon has stressed that this revolution is not just a more equitable distribution of what is made. This revolution is about transforming all the relations among people, how things are made, who decides, and towards what ends, and how people relate to each other on that foundation. This is what Marx called the four alls, digging up all class distinctions, all production relations, all social relations, all the production relations on which those class distinctions rest, all the social relations that correspond to those production relations, and all the traditional ideas that correspond to those. Communist morality is consistent with these four alls. It is consistent with the world we're striving to bring into being, and it serves as a guide as we struggle to get there. Communists see it as moral to fight against oppression and exploitation, and to fight for revolution, to challenge all forms of male supremacy, and to foster relations of mutual respect and equality between men and women, to take on all forms of white supremacy, national chauvinism, and racism, and to have a movement that forges revolutionary unity between people of different backgrounds, and that finds beauty in the diversity of cultures. It is moral to foster a critical spirit and a scientific approach, to want to be challenged when we are wrong, and to speak frankly with others when we think they are wrong, so that we can all learn and put what we have learned in the service of advancing the interests of humanity. To value the lives of people around the world as much as our own, and to think about and be stewards to the natural world and to humanity's future. It is moral to unite all who can be united, even as we wrangle over our differences today in the struggle against the crimes of this empire. This communist morality is a far better morality than the morality of slave owners and patriarchs of the Christian Bible or the Quran. It is better than the unquestioning passivity of saying God works in mysterious ways. It is a far better moral stance. It is a far better morality than acceptance, detachment, or individual enlightenment that leaves the dominant relations of this world intact. And it is a morality that is far better than the lookout for me and mine at the cost of others that is the morality of this capitalist era. This morality, communist morality, corresponds to changing the world and emancipating all of humanity. Thank you.
Everyone has some clowns. Okay. Stephen T. Asma is a professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago, where he holds the title of Distinguished Scholar. In 2003, he was visiting professor at the Buddhist Institute in Phnom Penh, if I said that wrong, Kingdom of Cambodia. There, he taught Buddhist philosophy as part of their graduate program in Buddhist studies, and he studied Theravada Buddhism throughout Southeast Asia. His book, chronicling that period, is entitled The Gods Drink Whiskey, Stumbling Toward Enlightenment in the Land of the Tattered Buddha. Asma is the author of 6 books, including Stuffed Animals and Pickled Heads, The Culture and Evolution of Natural History Museums, and the forthcoming On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. Both of these books are being published or were published by Oxford University Press. In addition, he has written many articles on a broad range of topics that bridge the humanities and the sciences. His work appears in the Chronicle of Higher Education, Chicago Tribune, In These Times Magazine, The Skeptical Inquirer, The American Philosophical Quarterly, Skeptic Magazine, The Journal of Biology and Philosophy, and he's also a regular contributor to Chicago Public Radio's news magazine show, 848. His best-selling graphic novel, Buddha for Beginners, has just been reissued. Let's welcome Professor Steve Asman.
I had this huge plate of Thai food right before we came here, and it just seems like a terrible idea to me right now. All right, the question before us is whether religion has a role to play in shaping and sustaining the human morality. As everybody knows, there are sort of provincial Christians and Muslims and Jews who think that morality must come from God's commandments, but probably everybody in here also knows very upstanding and righteous non-believers, and it seems to me that doing to others is something that I see the kids working out on the playground like 12 times a day, and it seems to me that children can understand the golden rule pretty quickly, and so it's pretty clear that religion per se is not the means of them at least contributing in some way. Communism, since Marx and to the present, has seen religion as an impediment to moral progress. But one of the greatest ethical challenges facing human beings today is toleration. The kind of tribal-based ethics that served our species well in the past is not as helpful these days. Having a strong sense of duty toward your own group and a willingness to harm competing groups were probably very important virtues in early rudimentary morality. And you find this kind of morality pretty commonly in primates and other social animals. And you definitely see it, as these guys were pointing out, in religious scriptures as well. Yahweh, for example, is always smiting and making good pleasantness for the non-chosen people. And this is true, obviously, in Islam, too, where there's a divided line between the righteous and the infidels. And in that sense, religion has always been part of this older logic of us and them. Now, however, we are supposedly civilized. We have the rule of law, we have science, we have ways of securing stability and safety that do not require force in the sense of individual citizens. Like, I don't have to particularly beat people up to get what I need. In our increasingly global village, we are experiencing unprecedented encounters with other cultures. There are now many more thems than our ancestors ever encountered. As we look to the future, then, the central moral question is how we will all get along in an increasingly pluralistic world. In our own melting pot, we seem to have struck a commendable live-and-let-live balance. But I think it has come directly from the separation of church and state. And the deal that Americans have struck is plurality works for us if we set our religious convictions aside when we meet in the public sphere. So the sort of deal we've made is religion, which honestly, American religion is as zealous as it gets, but generally the assumption is it should be a private matter, and the public sphere will bracket that stuff and look for other forms of solidarity. I'm not saying it works all the time, but that's the bargain. But secularization of the public sphere is not the only path to inclusivity. Brotherly love, a favorite theme of Pauline Christianity, is actually an attempt to broaden the close circle of kin to include strangers who are like your brother in the sense that they are fellow Christians. Many people will say, well, this is the universalism of Christianity and trying to make the small tribe bigger and bigger, although it appears to be, if you sort of look at these passages, it's definitely, it's still Christians versus everybody else. Although, you got to give it to Paul, because he said, you know, we have a new notion of the chosen ones. You don't have to get circumcised to join the new club of the chosen people. And in that sense, he's trying to make a larger us and hopefully a smaller them. I'd like to describe another religion, older than Christianity and Islam, a religion that also tried to enlarge the moral sphere to include not only strangers, but all human beings and even animals too, and I'm referring to Buddhism. A religion and a philosophy that complicates and defies the usual atheist-theist debate, and probably for that reason is usually left out of such debates. But by strange coincidence, Buddhism has been one of the favorite punching bags of 20th century communism. and not just in some academic arena, but in violent and brutal social engineering experiments. The Buddha was born in 563 in what is now Nepal, 563 BC. He waged a lifelong campaign against human suffering. He didn't do it the way most religious teachers do, however, by inventing another transcendental world, a heaven, where suffering doesn't exist. Gautama Siddhartha, the Buddha, generally opposed otherworldly metaphysics, including the entrenched Hindu caste system. The Vedic tradition, which Gautama grew up in, embraced an anatomical metaphor for human society. Before our current world existed, according to the Hindu legend, a gigantic primordial being named Purusha lived for eons. Purusha was eventually sacrificed by the gods and carved up into pieces. Purusha's head became the Brahmin of the priestly class. The warriors in the class of nobility were the Kshatriyas. They descended from the arms of this giant creature. And the merchant and craft classes, or the Vaishyas, are from the thighs. And as most of us know, the untouchable classes are descended from Purusha's ignoble feet. It was imperative, according to Hindu thought, that individuals of each caste resign themselves to their respective stations in the cosmic order. If you were born into an untouchable family, then you were destined to live with certain stigma, and you usually had certain kinds of work involving skinning animals, excrement removal. It was a pretty lousy life. And if you were of a Brahmin background, then your possibilities for education and good marriage and all that were much better for you. In response to cosmic class bigotry, the Buddha offered a radical new hierarchy, one that totally disrupted the old social categories. Some people may be better than others, he argued, but their superiority is not based on caste. Instead, we should accord greater respect on the basis of moral excellence. The Buddha wanted a social revolution wherein admiration and value would be reassigned according to good actions rather than genealogy. You actually see one of the things that has always drawn me to Buddhism, and I think draws many people to it, is even though it has a rich scriptural tradition, oftentimes what the Buddha is doing is actually giving arguments, which you rarely see in other religious traditions. You just don't see, well, premise one, premise two, conclusion. It just doesn't sort of fall out in the parables of Christianity this way. But the Buddha says, look, don't you look around and see Brahmins who are just total scumbags? I'm thinking that's not Sanskrit. And don't you look around and see, you know, really noble and righteous untouchables? And since that is the case, then shouldn't we accord respect according to this moral law? And so what you got in Buddhism was an early form of ethical meritocracy. And that made it very attractive to anybody who was not in Brahmin caste, you know, the vast majority of people. And so outcasts were frequently actually taken into the monasteries and so forth. The Buddha's ideas about ethics and morality are sort of encased in what have come to be known as the Four Noble Truths. I'll just sort of tick through these real quick. The Buddha meditates under the tree, very famously under the Bodhi tree, has his enlightenment and realizes these four truths. The first is that all life is suffering. The second is that all suffering is caused by craving or desire. The third is that letting go of craving liberates us from suffering. And then the fourth noble truth is, it's sort of the eight strategies by which you can actually let go of craving. And I don't have time to go through the eight in detail, but let me just sort of give you a thumbnail sketch for those of you who aren't that familiar with Buddhism, because it sounds awfully pessimistic. To live is to suffer. This might seem rather dark as an approach, but what he's saying is that if you have a body, you're open to suffering and degeneration, getting sick, growing old. Moreover, having family and friends means we are all open to the pain of loss, disappointment, and even betrayal. And this somewhat depressing view is not merely the product of a melancholy disposition. The Buddha had a sophisticated psychology and biological interpretation of this. He argues, I'm not going to get into this too deeply, but he says all human beings are made up of these five aggregates or khandhas. Body, feeling, disposition, consciousness, sensation. And he says there is no like ghost in the sort of ghost in the machine soul inside you that goes from one life to the next. It's a classic Hindu idea which he rejects. Rather, everybody's just this sort of bundle of perceptions and thoughts that hang together through a lifetime, and then when it's over, this sort of energy reconstitutes in some other form. So in that sense, it's a radically different metaphysics than the traditional I have a soul, I'm hoping to go on forever and ever and all that. Buddhism sort of rejects all that. Okay, the second noble truth moves beyond the mere fact of human suffering to explore the cause of this unhappy condition. Suffering is caused by craving or attachment. The Buddha argues that sensations enter in through the aggregates, these sort of sensations I'm talking about, and then this gives rise to craving. The sensual experiences themselves are not the cause of suffering. They're inherently neutral. Instead, it's the response or attitude that we initiate after we have this experience. So you have like some really great meal, you have some great sex, you plug in whatever phenomenal experience you've had, and then the problem is not that you had that experience, but then the ego jumps in and wants to hang on to it and cling to it and turn something that's inherently transient and impermanent into some kind of regular permanent thing. So that's the clinging is actually a psychological neurosis that all of us have. It seems to be part of the human nature. The third noble truth then is sort of teaching you how to basically detach from this craving. You can still have the experiences, but you want to basically avoid this obsessive relationship to the experience. In the Eightfold Path, he tries to explain how this can be done, because it's easier said than done. And I'm just going to give you one quick little slice of it so you get a picture. I'm going to talk a little bit about mindfulness, which is a crucial idea in Buddhism. Mindful meditation is usually focusing on the impermanence of all things. Think about your own body, the Buddha suggests. I must become more aware of it in the present moment, its weight, shape, movement, and my own ability to calm or agitate the whole body. I must become mindful of the body's ever-changing aspect, but then I must contemplate bodies generally by reflecting on their common nature. And what I find is that all bodies, my body, everybody's body, are decomposing sacks of flesh, tissues, organs, etc. Buddhism like relishes this stuff. When I was in Thailand, there were these caves where the monks live, and they spend all this time drawing the most disgusting images of rotting corpses, and they meditate on the rotting corpses and say, oh, there I am, that's my destiny as well. The Buddha describes human beings as a repulsive bag with openings at both ends filled with impurities. But it seems to me our contemporary culture is obsessed with body image. Mm-hmm. And we are surrounded by pictures of perfectly toned, hard bodies on TV and in magazines. Young girls become bulimic and anorexic over this stuff. Men are getting thigh implants and pectoral implants because their hours at the gym have failed to give them the comic book bodies they're after. Older folks are having themselves injected regularly with botulism in order to arrest the inevitable facial droop of aging. Skin is sliced, diced, grafted, and fat is sucked out while bones are broken and reset, all in pursuit of the urgent question, am I hot? It's sort of writing. Now, the Buddha doesn't know anything about these sci-fi technologies, but he understood very well that the human ego is tightly bound up and concerned with the body. So mindful meditation is designed to detach the ego from the body and to see it for what it is, an impermanent composite thing that cannot avoid eventual breakdown. How does this help with suffering? Isn't it just depressing? I'm not going to get into this too much. I guess what I want to sort of summarize here briefly by saying Buddhism is about finding a form of happiness that goes beyond the usual pursuit of fleeting pleasures. With introspection and discipline, Buddhism and other contemplative traditions attempt to find a state of well-being that is outside the usual game of desire fulfillment. These, then, are the core ideas of Buddhism. But in addition to these healthy ideas about psychology, one must also recognize that Buddhism has evolved into an elaborate, supernatural, devotional religion as well. I have lived in Cambodia and China and traveled all over Thailand, Laos, and Vietnam. I've seen the more superstitious aspects firsthand. Now, those who argue that we must do away with all religion in order to set humanity on the true path generally accept some formulation of Marx's famous slogan that religion is the opiate of the masses. It is the superstitious aspects of religion that usually warrant the drug metaphor. This might be true, but the zealous attempt on the part of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and the Red Guard in China to root out this opiate also rooted out all the good stuff about Buddhism that I've been sort of sketching here. The attempt to do away with all gods or religions always throws the baby out with the bathwater. There is much good medicine in Buddhism, just as there is much good medicine in other religions. But if the Asian communists found you practicing it in the 1970s, then you were as good as dead. And that is a form of militant atheism that sort of, I think, is worrying. Now, I want to make a much more radical argument. I can't believe I'm going to make this argument, and my heart is only halfway in it, but let's go for it. Up to this point, I've been suggesting that good medicines can be distilled out of the superstitious opiate religions, and we should be careful to preserve these more rational and more moral aspects of religion. Most moderates will find this argument appealing. But now I want to argue for the preservation of the wacky, superstitious, supernatural, cloud cuckoo land forms of religion as well. I believe these forms of religion sometimes do more good for our emotional lives, even when they compromise our more rational lives. Most debates about the moral value of religion assume monotheism as their central premise, and I've been offering an alternative by inserting Buddhism into the discussion, but since I've already moved things in this direction, let me take it a little further into the sort of exotic and describe a little bit about animism. And animism almost never comes up in these conversations. I think it probably should. Animistic beliefs dominate the everyday lives of Southeast Asians. There are local spirits called Nekpa in Cambodia, inhabiting almost every farm, home, river, road, and large tree. The Thais usually refer to these local spirits as Pi, and the Burmese refer to them as Nats. Even the shortest visit to this part of the world will make one familiar with the ever-present spirit houses that serve these tutelary spirits. They're everywhere in Southeast Asia. You see them at the Thai restaurant we were just at. They had one. They're in every Thai restaurant. Check. Everywhere in Southeast Asia, you'll find these little houses, and the offerings are made to the spirits to basically keep spirits in these houses so they won't sort of bother you in your home. And the offerings can be flowers or fruit, anything valuable and precious, and the spirits particularly like shot glasses of whiskey or other liquors. These offerings are designed to please Nekta and Pi, but also to distract them. And as I said before, like a friend of mine who's from Laos said, whenever there's a full moon, he always puts out shots of whiskey. Otherwise, the spirits will invade his children's dreams, and he mustn't sleep through the night. So he dopes up the gods so they'll leave his kids alone. The belief that nature is loaded with invisible spirits that live in local flora, fauna, and environmental landmarks is generally characterized by Westerners as primitive and highly irrational. And even religious devotees of monotheism in the developed West look down their noses at animism. The developed world usually tells a familiar narrative, which is sort of back in the day we were all animists, but then we got the one God together, and these guys are just, they're just not, they haven't really figured it out yet. But most of the world is made of animists. The West is naive when it imagines that the major options are monotheistic. In actual numbers and geographic spread, belief in nature spirits trounces the competing one goddess. Almost all of Africa, Southeast Asia, rural China, Tibet, Japan, rural South and Central America, indigenous Pacific Islands, pretty much everywhere except Western Europe, possibly the Middle East, and North America are all dominated by animistic beliefs. Even places where later religions like Buddhism and Catholicism enjoy formal recognition as national faiths, much older forms of animism comprise the daily concerns and rituals of people. The usual way of explaining this in the West is to say that animists are just uneducated and unscientific, and they'll eventually get on board with our ways. But I want to sort of suggest an alternative way of looking at them. I think in the West we view nature as lawful and predictable, and you know we have the scientific laws and so forth, and this has given us freedom and choice and self-determination, and this power is real, and I'm sincerely thankful to benefit from dentistry and cell theory, antibiotics, birth control, and anesthesia. Two things, though, are worth noting. One, contrary to its own self-image, monotheism hasn't really been rational ever. I mean, you know, there's a couple of moments, like Aquinas maybe, a little bit in Augustine, but by and large it's a faith-based system. Martin Luther suggesting that a good Christian should tear the eyes out of his reason is still a popular approach. And the second point worth making here is that animistic explanations of one's daily experiences may be every bit as rational as Western science if we take a closer look at life in the developing world. And so this is the sort of more radical, I've come to the most radical part of my talk and been informed that I have a minute left. That's right. I can do it.
All right.
What I want to suggest is that let me make this point. Religion, I think, even the wacky, superstitious stuff, is an important survival mechanism and sanctuary in the developing world. It provides some order, coherence, respite, peace, traction against the fates, and perhaps most importantly, it quells the emotional distress of human vulnerability. I'm an agnostic and a citizen of a wealthy nation, but when my own son was suffering in the emergency room from an illness, I prayed spontaneously. I'm not naive. I don't think it did a damn thing to heal him. But when people have their backs against the wall, when they are truly helpless and hopeless, then groveling and negotiating with anything more powerful than yourself is a very human response. A response that will not go away, that should not go away, if it provides some genuine relief for anxiety and agony. This is my last point. I don't think religion is a path to morality, and it definitely cannot substitute for scientific understanding of nature. Its chief virtue is as a coping mechanism for troubles. Powerless people turn to religion and find a sense of virtual power there, and this helps them psychologically to stay afloat. Those who target religion and wish to abolish it seek to pull away the life preserver, mistakenly blaming the flotation device for the drowning. Then you want to know, okay, so there's good religion and bad religion. And my last point is, it seems to me we can actually make fairly intelligent decisions about what kind of religions we should sustain and promote, and those which we should try to diminish. Those which contribute to greater humanization and sanctuary should be promoted. Those that I think are basically dehumanizing and leading to factionalism and dogma should be demoted. And so what I'm trying to argue is that there's a lot in religion worth saving, and it shouldn't all go away. So, all right, thank you.